Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on April 7th of 2019 under the headline, Skunk's Beautiful Pelt Was Best Admired from Afar. Here we go. One of the most appealing things about life in rural western Oregon around the middle of the last century was the wildlife. Loggers and mill workers in places like Valsetts and Wendling might not have gotten paid particularly well, but they worked and lived in a real sportsman's paradise. The fishing, hunting, boating, and wilderness trekking opportunities were like a second paycheck. Sometimes, as in the case of loggers who ran trap lines on the side, it was a literal second paycheck. Sometimes, too, folks would get a little too much of a good thing, and all that wildlife would get just a little too wild for comfort. Dr. E. R. Huckleberry, writing his memoirs at the end of a half-decade in family practice at Garibaldi, tells several particularly juicy anecdotes about this. Huckleberry was, from the 1920s through the 1960s, the MD who was called when accidents happened on nearby Tillamook County logging shows. So he got to be quite familiar with logging operations and loggers, and he was the physician that many loggers and mill workers looked to when they needed medical attention. Sometime in the 1930s, probably before the Tillamook burn, but Dr. Huckleberry does not say, a logger he identifies only as Clarence came to see him one day with a somewhat unusual medical request. Actually, his problem wasn't very medical at all. But the logger was desperate and thought maybe the good doctor would know something he didn't know about how to address it. He was, as Huckleberry puts it, redolent of eau de skunk. This logger, it seems, had been working at the White Star logging camp for several months deep in the woods of Tillamook County and noticed there was an abundance of fur-bearing animals around. So he'd started running a trap line as a side hustle. Getting up every morning before daylight, he'd run around and check his traps, collect any animals caught in them, set new ones, and be back in time for breakfast. Pretty soon, Clarence was doing very well. By the time he came to see Dr. Huckleberry, he'd gotten to where he was making almost as much money running that trap line as he was cutting timber. But on that particular day, as he was coming back to camp following a narrow game trail with dense brush on both sides like a tunnel, barely wide enough to admit him, he saw, by the early pre-dawn light, strolling leisurely toward him on that trail, a great fluffy skunk. No person or animal will dispute the right-of-way with a skunk, so Clarence pushed off the trail into the bushes far enough to let Mr. Skunk get by, Dr. Huckleberry writes. It was a beautiful pelt, one of the finest he had ever seen, and to have it walk past, touching his feet, was more than he could stand. It suddenly occurred to him that if he grabbed that animal by the tail, held it at arm's length ahead of him, and ran so fast the skunk could not get turned around to train its artillery on him, and when he came to a more open place, he could give a big swing and bang its head against a tree. Without thinking his plan through much more than that, Clarence reached down and implemented phase one on the spot. As you will no doubt have gathered, things did not go strictly according to Clarence's plan. The main thing he didn't take into account was where he was in that dense tunnel of underbrush. It was so far to any open space that long before he got anywhere near a tree big enough to safely bounce a skunk off of, he was stumbling and gasping for breath. The skunk, at that point still as fresh as a daisy and presumably somewhat put out by all the rough handling, then managed to get itself turned around, and as Dr. Huckleberry puts it, gave him both barrels at close range. By the time Clarence could get his eyes open and begin to breathe again, of course, the skunk was gone, he continues. But there remained conclusive evidence that it had been there. Clarence stripped off his clothes, dug a hole with his hunting knife, and buried them. Then he snuck into the bathhouse to take a shower. This, of course, did not help much. When he tried to get into the bunkhouse to get more clothes, the other loggers chased him out. Then one of them, taking pity on the poor stinky wretch, got a set of clothes from his bedroll and threw it to him from as far upwind as possible. When he tried to go into the mess shack for breakfast, the cook chased him out, telling him to wait 15 minutes and then he'd find his breakfast on a stump at the edge of camp. When he tried to go to work, the boys wouldn't let him on the mulligan, and his logging partner told him not to bother walking up to the job as he wouldn't work with him again until he smelled better. Clarence decided to take the hint and caught the next Loki, logging locomotive, back to civilization. To get on board, he had to promise to get on the very last train car and stay there the whole way. In desperation, he walked to Dr. Huckleberry's office to inquire if medical science had yet doped out a deodorization technology potent enough to meet this challenge. If Clarence had thought things through, he probably would have sought out a veterinarian instead. Very few of his fellow humans are dumb enough to tangle with a skunk, but plenty of dogs are, and a good country vet would have had several pretty solid deodorization strategies to recommend. Dr. Huckleberry, though, didn't have much experience deodorizing loggers, and told the poor stinky fellow as much. He suggested, though, that Clarence might try a series of Clorox baths. The young logger had a sister who lived in town, and she agreed to let him use her bathtub to do them, provided he entered and exited by the window, left the window open after he left, and never opened the bathroom door. Her family trooped across the street to the neighbor's house for bathroom business for a week or so while Clarence tried this. It didn't help much, if at all. But of course, time passed and the smell faded, and a few days later, Clarence was able to go back to work. He said running that trap line was no fun anymore, Dr. Huckleberry added. However, he felt he had to keep up with it to make up for the time and clothes that skunk had cost him. Another local who had some trouble with wildlife, according to Dr. Huckleberry's recollections, was local dairy farmer and midnight bootlegger Alex Swenson. Alex's bootlegging operations, tucked away in the hilly and heavily overgrown back 40 of his dairy farm, were far more lucrative than his farm ever had been. Most bootleggers caught by prohibition agents in Tillamook County were busted after someone smelled the distinctive aroma of fermentation or spotted a smoke trail seen rising from the same remote spot day after day. Dairy farms, of course, have a powerful smell associated with them. And part of that smell is silage, which is fermented feedstock. So, Alec had the smell part covered. Anyone who caught a whiff of his mash tun drifting on the wind would just think it was silage. To avoid the smoke, though, he powered his still with a kerosene stove. This worked great, but it required him to sneak up to the still in the middle of the night with cans of kerosene to fuel it. One fine summer day, he was doing this when he rounded a clump of blackberry bushes and found himself in the middle of a family of bears. One of the cubs was right in the trail, and Alec almost stepped on him. Alec immediately made things even worse by dropping the can of kerosene on the cub's paw. The little critter bawled like a baby, his mother roared with wrath, and the chase was on. "The nearest tree was a little alder, but it looked better than nothing, and that bear was gaining on me," Alec told Dr. Huckleberry. "So up I went, as high as I could get. But that wasn't very high. Mama Bear was on her hind legs, clawing and scratching at my boots and missing them by inches only. This went on for some time, and she showed no sign of getting tired of the game. At last I thought of my snooze can. It was nearly full." Snooze, as you probably know, is a tobacco product that was very popular with Scandinavians and loggers, people with names like Swenson. It's similar to moist snuff like Copenhagen, but mixed with salt and other flavoring agents. It has an extremely potent flavor, and to the uninitiated, not a particularly pleasant one. The desperate Alec Swenson now pulled his snooze can out of his back pocket, got the lid off, and when the moment was ripe and those gnashing fangs were out and reaching for him, dumped its entire contents down that slavering hatch. "She looked surprised, dropped on all fours, started coughing and clawing at her face, and then headed for the crick, making noises that sounded like ope, ope, ope," Alec told Dr. Huckleberry. "She didn't even wait to call the cubs, but they followed. I climbed down, retrieved my can of oil, and tended to my still." If that last line makes you a bit suspicious of this story, it should. It's pretty hard to imagine anyone coming off an encounter like this not turning around and running for the house. Who could have known how long Mother Bear would be at the crick washing her mouth out, or how long her memory would be afterwards? So, most likely this story should be filed as folklore rather than documentable history. It, or something like it, probably did happen, but the chances are pretty good that it's been added to, maybe just a little bit. The exclusive source for this story has been The Adventures of Dr. Huckleberry, a book by E.R. Huckleberry, published by Oregon Historical Society Press in 1970. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatorgan.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. By the way, if you like this kind of stuff, you might be interested in my other podcast. It's called The Penny Dreadful Story Hour, and it's basically an early Victorian variety show. I read a chapter from each of six classic Penny Dreadful story papers published between 1840 and 1866 with historical and sociological commentary and definitions of the flash cant slang lingo used by Romany family coves and bold highway robbers and titled Regency roisterers and such. The Dreadfuls we're working through right now are Sweeney Todd, Highwayman Dick Turpin, Varney the Vampire, an international espionage series called The Black Band, and a couple other whacking great stories. Check it out. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can cut straight to it at pulp-lit.com/pennydread. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.